The glare of its camphene lamps brought out the dark asterisks produced on the white sand of its floor by expectoration. In another year of our Lord, namely 1941, I caught some very good moths at the neon lights of a gasoline station between Dallas and Fort Worth. Into the bar comes the villain, the slave-whipping Mississippian, ex-captain of volunteers, handsome, swaggering, scowling Cassius Calhoun. After toasting America for Americans and confusion to all foreign interlopers, especially the D-D, an evasion that puzzled me sorely when I first stumbled upon it, dead, detested, Irish, he intentionally collided with Maurice the Mustanger, scarlet scarf, slashed velvet trousers, hot Irish blood. A young horse trader, who was really a baronet, Sir Maurice Gerald, as his thrilled bride was to discover at the end of the book. Wrong thrills like this may have been one of the reasons that the Irish-born author's fame waned so soon in his adopted country. Immediately after the collision, Maurice performed several actions in the following order. He deposited his glass upon the counter, drew a silk handkerchief from his pocket, wiped from his embroidered shirt bosom the defilement of the whiskey, transferred the handkerchief from his right hand to his left, took the half-empty glass from the counter, swilled its remaining contents into Calhoun's face, quietly redeposited the glass upon the counter. This sequence I still know by heart, so often did my cousin and I enact it. The duel took place there and then, in the emptied barroom, the men using Colt's six-shooters. Despite my interest in the fight, both were wounded, their blood spurted all over the sanded floor. I could not prevent myself from leaving the saloon in my fancy to mingle with the hushed crowd in front of the hotel, so as to make out, in the scented dark, certain señoritas of questionable calling. With still more excitement did I read of Louise Poindexter, Calhoun's fair cousin, daughter of a sugar planter, the highest and haughtiest of his class, though why an old man who planted sugar should be high and haughty was a mystery to me. She is revealed in the throes of jealousy, which I used to feel so keenly at miserable parties when Mara Rzewuski, a pale child with a white silk bow in her black hair, suddenly and inexplicably stopped noticing me, standing upon the edge of her azotea, her white hand resting upon the copestone of the parapet which is still wet with the dews of night, her twin breasts sinking and swelling in quick spasmodic breathing, her twin breasts, let me reread, sinking and swelling, her lorgnette directed. That lorgnette I found afterward in the hands of Madame Bovary, and later Anna Karenin had it, and then it passed into the possession of Chekhov's lady with the lapdog, and was lost by her on the pier at Yalta. When Louise held it, it was directed toward the speckled shadows under the mesquites, where the horseman of her choice was having an innocent conversation with the daughter of a wealthy haciendado, Doña Isidora Covarrubio de los Llanos, whose head of hair in luxuriance rivaled the tail of a wild steed. I had the opportunity, Maurice later explained to Louise as one rider to another, of being useful to Doña Isidora in once rescuing her from some rude Indians. A slight service, you call it, the young Creole exclaimed. A man who should do that much for me. What would you do for him? Asked Maurice eagerly. Pardieu, I should love him. Then I would give half my life to see you in the hands of Wildcat and his drunken comrades, and the other half to deliver you from the danger. And here we find the gallant author interpolating a strange confession. The sweetest kiss that I ever had in my life was when a woman, a fair creature in the hunting field, leant over in her saddle and kissed me as I sate in mine. The sate, let us concede, gives duration and body to the kiss which the captain so comfortably had, but I could not help feeling, even at the age of 11, that centaurian lovemaking was not without its special limitations. Moreover, Yuri and I both knew a boy who had tried it, but the girl's horse had pushed his into a ditch. Exhausted by our adventures in the chaparral, we lay on the grass and discussed women. Our innocence seems to me now almost monstrous in the light of various sexual confessions to be found in Havelock Ellis and elsewhere, which involve tiny tots mating like mad. The slums of sex were unknown to us. Had we ever happened to hear about two normal lads idiotically masturbating in each other's presence, as described so sympathetically with all the smells in modern American novels, the mere notion of such an act would have seemed to us as comic and impossible as sleeping with an amylus. Our ideal was Queen Guinevere, Isolde, a not quite merciless belle dame, another man's wife, proud and docile, fashionable and fast, with slim ankles and narrow hands. The little girls in neat socks and pumps whom we and other boys used to meet at dancing lessons or at Christmas tree parties had all the enchantments, all the sweets and stars of the tree preserved in their flame-dotted iris, and they teased us. They glanced back. They delightfully participated in our vaguely festive dreams. But they belonged, those nymphets, to another class of creatures than the adolescent belles and large-hatted vamps for whom we actually yearned. After having made me sign an oath of secrecy with blood, Yuri told me about the married lady in Warsaw, with whom at 12 or 13 he was secretly in love, and whom a couple of years later he made love to. By comparison, it would have sounded jejune, I feared, to tell him about my seaside playmates, but I cannot recall what substitute I invented to match his romance. Around that time, though, a real romantic adventure did come my way. I am now going to do something quite difficult, a kind of double somersault with a Welsh waggle. Old acrobats will know what I mean. And I want complete silence, please. 3. In August 1910, my brother and I were in Bad Kissingen with our parents and tutor, Lenski. After that, my father and mother traveled to Munich and Paris, and back to St. Petersburg, and then to Berlin, where we boys, with Lenski, were spending the autumn and the beginning of the winter, having our teeth fixed. An American dentist, Lowell or Lowen, I do not remember his name exactly, ripped some of our teeth out and trussed up others with twine before disfiguring us with braces. Even more hellish than the action of the rubber pair pumping hot pain into a cavity were the cotton pads. I could not endure their dry contact and squeak, which used to be thrust between gum and tongue for the operator's convenience. And there would be, in the window pane before one's helpless eyes, a transparency, some dismal seascape or gray grapes, shuddering with the dull reverberations of distant trams under dull skies. In den Zelten 18a. The address comes back to me, dancing trochaically, immediately followed by the whispery motion of the cream-colored electric taxi that took us there. We expected every possible compensation and atonement for those dreadful mornings. My brother loved the museum of wax figures in the arcade off the Unter den Linden. Friedrich's Grenadiers, Bonaparte communing with a mummy, young Liszt, who composed a rhapsody in his sleep, and Marat, who died in a shoe. And for me, who did not know yet that Marat had been an ardent lepidopterist, there was, at the corner of that arcade, Gruber's famous butterfly shop, a camphoraceous paradise at the top of a steep, narrow staircase, which I climbed every other day to inquire if Chapman's new hair streak or Mann's recently rediscovered white had been obtained for me at last. We tried tennis on a public court, but a wintry gale kept chasing dead leaves across it, and besides, Lenski could not really play, although insisting on joining us without removing his overcoat in a lopsided threesome. Subsequently, most of our afternoons were spent at a roller-skating rink in the Kurfürstendamm. I remember Lenski rolling inexorably toward a pillar which he attempted to embrace while collapsing with a dreadful clatter. And after persevering a while, he would content himself with sitting in one of the loges that flanked the plush parapet, and consuming there wedges of slightly salty mocha torte with whipped cream, while I kept self-sufficiently overtaking poor, gamely, stumbling Sergei, one of those galling little pictures that revolve on and on in one's mind. A military band, Germany at the time was the land of music, manned by an uncommonly jerky conductor, came to life every 10 minutes or so, but could hardly drown the ceaseless, sweeping rumble of wheels. There existed in Russia, and still exists, no doubt, a special type of school-age boy who, without necessarily being athletic in appearance or outstanding in mental scope, often having, in fact, no energy in class, a rather scrawny physique and even perhaps a touch of pulmonary consumption, excels quite phenomenally at soccer and chess, and learns with the utmost ease and grace any kind of sport or game of skill. Boryashik, Kostya Bugatov, the famous brothers Sharabanov, where are they now, my teammates and rivals? I was a good skater on ice, and switching to rollers was for me not more difficult than for a man to replace an ordinary razor by a safety one. Very quickly I learned two or three tricky steps on the wooden floor of the rink, and in no ballroom have I danced with more zest or ability. We, Sheiks and Bugatovs, are poor ballroom dancers as a rule. The several instructors wore scarlet uniforms, half hussar and half hotel page. They all spoke English, of one brand or another. Among the regular visitors, I soon noticed a group of American young ladies. At first, they all merged in a common spin of bright, exotic beauty. The process of differentiation began when, during one of my lone dances, and a few seconds before I came the worst cropper that I ever came on a rink, somebody said something about me as I whirled by, and a wonderful, twangy, feminine voice answered, "Yes, isn't he cunning?" I can still see her tall figure in a navy blue tailor-made suit. Her large velvet hat was transfixed by a dazzling pin. For obvious reasons, I decided her name was Louise. At night I would lie awake and imagine all kinds of romantic situations, and think of her willowy waist and white throat, and worry over an odd discomfort that I had associated before only with chafing shorts. One afternoon I saw her standing in the lobby of the rink, and the most dashing of the instructors, a sleek ruffian of the Calhoun type, was holding her by the wrist and interrogating her with a crooked grin, and she was looking away and childishly turning her wrist this way and that in his grasp. And the following night he was shot, lassoed, buried alive, shot again, throttled, bitingly insulted, coolly aimed at, spared, and left to drag a life of shame. High-principled, but rather simple, Lenski, who was abroad for the first time, had some trouble keeping the delights of sightseeing in harmony with his pedagogical duties. We took advantage of this and guided him toward places where our parents might not have allowed us to go. He could not resist the Wintergarten, for instance, and so one night we found ourselves there, drinking iced chocolate in an orchestra box. The show developed on the usual lines. A juggler in evening clothes, then a woman with flashes of rhinestones on her bosom trilling a concert aria in alternating effusions of green and red light, then a comic on roller skates. Between him and a bicycle act, of which more later, there was an item on the program called the Gala Girls, and with something of the shattering and ignominious physical shock I had experienced when coming that cropper on the rink, I recognized my American ladies in the garland of linked, shrill-voiced, shameless girls, all rippling from left to right and then from right to left with a rhythmic rising of 10 identical legs that shot up from 10 corollas of flounces. I located my Louise's face and knew at once that it was all over, that I had lost her, that I would never forgive her for singing so loudly, for smiling so redly, for disguising herself in that ridiculous way so unlike the charm of either proud Creoles or questionable señoritas. I could not stop thinking of her altogether, of course, but the shock seems to have liberated in me a certain inductive process, for I soon noticed that any evocation of the feminine form would be accompanied by the puzzling discomfort already familiar to me. I asked my parents about it. They had come to Berlin to see how we were getting along, and my father ruffled the German newspaper he had just opened and replied in English, with the parody of a possible quotation, a manner of speech he often adopted in order to get going. "That, my boy, is just another of nature's absurd combinations, like shame and blushes, or grief and red eyes." "Tolstoy vient de mourir," he suddenly added, in another, stunned voice, turning to my mother. "Dutch Totti!" Something like, "Good gracious," she exclaimed in distress, clasping her hands in her lap. "Pora domoi," time to go home, she concluded, as if Tolstoy's death had been the portent of apocalyptic disasters. 4. And now comes the bicycle act, or at least my version of it. The following summer, Yuri did not visit us at Vera, and I was left alone to cope with my romantic agitation. On rainy days, crouching at the foot of a little used bookshelf, in a poor light that did all it could to discourage my furtive inquiry, I used to look up obscure, obscurely tantalizing and enervating terms in the Russian 82-volume edition of Brockhaus's Encyclopedia, where, in order to save space, the title word of this or that article would be reduced throughout a detailed discussion to its capitalized initial, so that the columns of dense print in minion type, besides taxing one's attention, acquired the trumpery fascination of a masquerade, at which the abbreviation of a none-too-familiar word played hide-and-seek with one's avid eyes. Moses tried to abolish P, but failed. In modern times, hospitable P flourished in Austria under Maria Theresa. In many parts of Germany, the profits from P went to the clergy. In Russia, P has been officially tolerated since 1843. Seduced at the age of 10 or 12 by her master, his sons or one of his menials, an orphan almost invariably ends in P. And so forth, all of which went to enrich with mystery, rather than soberly elucidate, the allusions to meretricious love that I met with during my first immersions in Chekhov or Andreev. Butterfly hunting and various sports took care of the sunny hours, but no amount of exercise could prevent the restlessness which every evening launched me on vague voyages of discovery. After riding on horseback most of the afternoon, bicycling in the colored dusk was a curiously subtle, almost discarnate feeling. I had turned upside down and lowered to sub-saddle level the handlebars of my Enfield bicycle, converting it into my conception of a racing model. Along the paths of the park I would skim, following yesterday's patterned imprint of Dunlop tires, neatly avoiding the ridges of tree roots, selecting a fallen twig and snapping it with my sensitive front wheel, weaving between two flat leaves and then between a small stone and the hole from which it had been dislodged the evening before, enjoying the brief smoothness of a bridge over a brook, skirting the wire fence of the tennis court, nuzzling open the little whitewashed gate at the end of the park, and then, in a melancholy ecstasy of freedom, speeding along the hard-baked, pleasantly agglutinate margins of long country roads. That summer I would always ride by a certain izba, golden in the low sun, in the doorway of which Polenka, the daughter of our head coachman Zahar, a girl of my age, would stand leaning against the jamb, her bare arms folded on her breast in a soft, comfortable manner peculiar to rural Russia. She would watch me approach with a wonderful, welcoming radiance on her face, but as I rode nearer, this would dwindle to a half-smile, then to a faint light at the corners of her compressed lips, and finally this too would fade, so that when I reached her, there would be no expression at all on her round, pretty face. As soon as I had passed, however, and had turned my head for an instant to take a last look before sprinting uphill, the dimple would be back. The enigmatic light would be playing again on her dear features. I never spoke to her, but long after I had stopped riding by at that hour, our ocular relationship was renewed from time to time during 2 or 3 summers. She would appear from nowhere, always standing a little apart, always barefoot, rubbing her left instep against her right calf, or scratching with her fourth finger the parting in her light brown hair, and always leaning against things, against the stable door while my horse was being saddled, against the trunk of a tree when the whole array of country servitors would be seeing us off to town for the winter on a crisp September morning. Every time, her bosom seemed a little softer, her forearms a little stronger, and once or twice I discerned, just before she drifted out of my ken, at 16 she married a blacksmith in a distant village, a gleam of gentle mockery in her wide-set hazel eyes. Strange to say, she was the first to have the poignant power by merely not letting her smile fade, of burning a hole in my sleep and jolting me into clammy consciousness whenever I dreamed of her, although in real life I was even more afraid of being revolted by her dirt-caked feet and stale-smelling clothes than of insulting her by the triteness of quasi-senioral advances. 5. There are two especially vivid aspects of her that I would like to hold up simultaneously before my eyes in conclusion of her haunting image. The first lived for a long while within me quite separately from the Polenka I associated with doorways and sunsets, as if I had glimpsed a nymphian incarnation of her pitiful beauty that were better left alone. One June day, the year when she and I were both 13, on the banks of the Oradesh, I was engaged in collecting some so-called Parnassians, Parnassius mnemosyne to be exact, strange butterflies of ancient lineage, with rustling, glazed, semi-transparent wings, and catkin-like flossy abdomens. My quest had led me into a dense undergrowth of milky white racemosa and dark alder at the very edge of the cold blue river, when suddenly there was an outburst of splashes and shouts, and from behind a fragrant bush I caught sight of Polenka and three or four other naked children bathing from the ruins of an old bathhouse a few feet away. Wet, gasping, one nostril of her snub nose running, the ribs of her adolescent body arched under her pale, goose-pimpled skin, her calves flecked with black mud, a curved comb burning in her damp, darkened hair, she was scrambling away from the swish and clack of water lily stems that a drum-bellied girl with a shaven head and a shamelessly excited stripling wearing around the loins a kind of string locally used against the evil eye were yanking out of the water and harrying her with. And for a second or two, before I crept away in a dismal haze of disgust and desire, I saw a strange Polenka shiver and squat on the boards of the half-broken wharf, covering her breasts against the east wind with her crossed arms, while with the tip of her tongue she taunted her pursuers. The other picture refers to a Sunday at Christmastide in 1916. From the silent, snow-blanketed platform of the little station of Siversky on the Warsaw Line, it was the nearest to our country place, I was watching a distant silvery grove as it changed to lead under the evening sky, and waiting for it to emit the dull violet smoke of the train that would take me back to St. Petersburg after a day of skiing. The smoke duly appeared, and at the same moment, she and another girl walked past me, heavily kerchiefed in huge felt boots and horrible, shapeless, long quilted jackets, with the stuffing showing at the torn spots of the coarse black cloth, and as she passed, Polenka, a bruise under her eye and a puffed-up lip, did her husband beat her on Saturdays, remarked in wistful and melodious tones to nobody in particular,
"A barchuk to menya na prizna.
Look, the young master does not know me." And that was the only time I ever heard her speak. 6. The summer evenings of my boyhood when I used to ride by her cottage speak to me in that voice of hers now. On a road among fields where it met the desolate highway, I would dismount and prop my bicycle against a telegraph pole. A sunset, almost formidable in its splendor, would be lingering in the fully exposed sky. Among its imperceptibly changing amassments, one could pick out brightly stained structural details of celestial organisms, or glowing slits in dark banks, or flat ethereal beaches that looked like mirages of desert islands. I did not know then, as I know perfectly well now, what to do with such things, how to get rid of them, how to transform them into something that can be turned over to the reader in printed characters to have him cope with the blessed shiver. And this inability enhanced my oppression. A colossal shadow would begin to invade the fields, and the telegraph poles hummed in the stillness, and the night feeders ascended the stems of their plants. Nibble, 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 went a handsome striped caterpillar, not figured in Spuler, as he clung to a campanula stalk, working down with his mandibles along the edge of the nearest leaf out of which he was eating a leisurely hemicircle, then again extending his neck, and again bending it gradually as he deepened the neat concave. Automatically, I might slip him, with a bit of his plantlet, into a matchbox to take home with me, and have him produce next year a splendid surprise. But my thoughts were elsewhere. Zina and Colette, my seaside playmates. Louise the Prancer. All the flushed, low-sashed, silky-haired little girls at festive parties. Languorous Countess G, my cousin's lady. Polenka, smiling in the agony of my new dreams. All would merge to form somebody I did not know, but was bound to know soon. I recall one particular sunset. It lent an ember to my bicycle bell. Overhead, above the black music of telegraph wires, a number of long, dark violet clouds lined with flamingo pink hung motionless in a fan-shaped arrangement. The whole thing was like some prodigious ovation in terms of color and form. It was dying, however, and everything else was darkening, too. But just above the horizon, in a lucid turquoise space, beneath the black stratus, the eye found a vista that only a fool could mistake for the spare parts of this or any other sunset. It occupied a very small sector of the enormous sky, and had the peculiar neatness of something seen through the wrong end of a telescope. There it lay in wait, a family of serene clouds in miniature, an accumulation of brilliant convolutions, anachronistic in their creaminess and extremely remote. Remote, but perfect in every detail. Fantastically reduced, but faultlessly shaped. My marvelous tomorrow, ready to be delivered to me. Chapter 11 1 In order to reconstruct the summer of 1914, when the numb fury of verse-making first came over me, all I really need is to visualize a certain pavilion. There the lank 15-year-old lad I then was sought shelter during a thunderstorm, of which there was an inordinate number that July. I dream of my pavilion at least twice a year. As a rule, it appears in my dreams quite independently of their subject matter, which of course may be anything from abduction to zoolatry. It hangs around, so to speak, with the unobtrusiveness of an artist's signature. I find it clinging to a corner of the dream canvas, or cunningly worked into some ornamental part of the picture. At times, however, it seems to be suspended in the middle distance, a trifle baroque, and yet in tune with the handsome trees, dark fir and bright birch, whose sap once ran through its timber. Wine red and bottle green and dark blue lozenges of stained glass lend a chapel-like touch to the lattice work of its casements. It is just as it was in my boyhood, a sturdy old wooden structure above a ferny ravine in the older riverside part of our Vera Park. Just as it was, or perhaps a little more perfect. In the real thing, some of the glass was missing. Crumpled leaves had been swept in by the wind. The narrow little bridge that arched across the gill at its deepest part, with the pavilion rising midway like a coagulated rainbow, was as slippery after a rainy spell as if it had been coated with some dark and, in a sense, magic ointment. Etymologically, pavilion and papilio are closely related. Inside, there was nothing in the way of furniture except a folding table hinged rustily to a wall under the east window, through the two or three glassless or pale-glassed compartments of which, among the bloated blues and drunken reds, one could catch a glimpse of the river. On a floorboard at my feet, a dead horsefly lay on its back near the brown remains of a birch ammet, and the patches of disintegrating whitewash on the inside of the door had been used by various trespassers for such jottings as, "Dasha, Tamara, and Lena have been here," or "Down with Austria." The storm passed quickly. The rain, which had been a mass of violently descending water wherein the trees writhed and rolled, was reduced all at once to oblique lines of silent gold breaking into short and long dashes against the background of subsiding vegetable agitation. Gulfs of voluptuous blue were expanding between great clouds, heap upon heap of pure white and purplish gray. Lepota, old Russian for stately beauty, moving mists, gouache and guano, among the curves of which one could distinguish a mammary illusion or the death mask of a poet. The tennis court was a region of great lakes. Beyond the park, above steaming fields, a rainbow slipped into view. The fields ended in the notched dark border of a remote fir wood. Part of the rainbow went across it, and that section of the forest edge shimmered most magically through the pale green and pink of the iridescent veil drawn before it. A tenderness and a glory that made poor relatives of the rhomboidal colored reflections which the return of the sun had brought forth on the pavilion floor. A moment later my first poem began. What touched it off? I think I know. Without any wind blowing, the sheer weight of a raindrop, shining in parasitic luxury on a chordate leaf, caused its tip to dip, and what looked like a globule of quicksilver performed a sudden glissando down the center vein, and then, having shed its bright load, the relieved leaf unbent. Tip, leaf, dip, relief. The instant it all took to happen seemed to me not so much a fraction of time as a fissure in it, a missed heartbeat, which was refunded at once by a patter of rhymes. I say patter intentionally, for when a gust of wind did come, the trees would briskly start to drip all together in as crude an imitation of the recent downpour as the stanza I was already muttering resembled the shock of wonder I had experienced when, for a moment, heart and leaf had been one. 2. In the avid heat of the early afternoon, benches, bridges, and bowls, all things, in fact, save the tennis court, were drying with incredible rapidity, and soon little remained of my initial inspiration. Although the bright fissure had closed, I doggedly went on composing. My medium happened to be Russian, but could have been just as well Ukrainian or basic English or Volapük. The kind of poem I produced in those days was hardly anything more than a sign I made of being alive, of passing or having passed or hoping to pass through certain intense human emotions. It was a phenomenon of orientation rather than of art, thus comparable to stripes of paint on a roadside rock or to a pillared heap of stones marking a mountain trail. But then, in a sense, all poetry is positional. To try to express one's position in regard to the universe embraced by consciousness is an immemorial urge. The arms of consciousness reach out and grope, and the longer they are, the better. Tentacles, not wings, are Apollo's natural members. Vivian Bloodmark, a philosophical friend of mine in later years, used to say that while the scientist sees everything that happens in one point of space, the poet feels everything that happens in one point of time. Lost in thought, he taps his knee with his wand-like pencil, and at the same instant a car, New York license plate, passes along the road. A child bangs the screen door of a neighboring porch, an old man yawns in a misty Turkestan orchard, a granule of cinder-gray sand is rolled by the wind on Venus, a Dr. Jacques Hirsch in Grenoble puts on his reading glasses, and trillions of other such trifles occur, all forming an instantaneous and transparent organism of events, of which the poet, sitting in a lawn chair at Ithaca, New York, is the nucleus. That summer I was still far too young to evolve any wealth of cosmic synchronization, to quote my philosopher again. But I did discover, at least, that a person hoping to become a poet must have the capacity of thinking of several things at a time. In the course of the languid rambles that accompany the making of my first poem, I ran into the village schoolmaster, an ardent socialist, a good man, intensely devoted to my father. I welcome this image again. Always with a tight posy of wildflowers, always smiling, always perspiring. While politely discussing with him my father's sudden journey to town, I registered simultaneously and with equal clarity not only his wilting flowers, his flowing tie, and the blackheads on the fleshy volutes of his nostrils, but also the dull little voice of a cuckoo coming from afar, and the flash of a Queen of Spain settling on the road, and the remembered impression of the pictures, enlarged agricultural pests and bearded Russian writers in the well-aerated classrooms of the village school which I had once or twice visited. And to continue a tabulation that hardly does justice to the ethereal simplicity of the whole process, the throb of some utterly irrelevant recollection, A pedometer I had lost was released from a neighboring brain cell, and the savor of the grass stalk I was chewing mingled with the cuckoo's note and the fritillary's takeoff, and all the while I was richly, serenely aware of my own manifold awareness. He beamed, and he bowed, in the effusive manner of a Russian radical, and took a couple of steps backward, and turned, and jauntily went on his way, and I picked up the thread of my poem. During the short time I had been otherwise engaged, something seemed to have happened to such words as I had already strung together. They did not look quite as lustrous as they had before the interruption. Some suspicion crossed my mind that I might be dealing in dummies. Fortunately, this cold twinkle of critical perception did not last. The fervor I had been trying to render took over again and brought its medium back to an illusory life. The ranks of words I reviewed were again so glowing with their puffed-out little chests and trim uniforms that I put down to mere fancy the sagging I had noticed out of the corner of my eye. 3. Apart from credulous inexperience, a young Russian versificator had to cope with a special handicap. In contrast to the rich vocabulary of satirical or narrative verse, the Russian elegy suffered from a bad case of verbal anemia. Only in very expert hands could it be made to transcend its humble origin, the pallid poetry of 18th-century France. True, in my day a new school was in the act of ripping up the old rhythms, but it was still to the latter that the conservative beginner turned in search of a neutral instrument, possibly because he did not wish to be diverted from the simple expression of simple emotions by adventures in hazardous form. Form, however, got its revenge. The rather monotonous designs into which early 19th-century Russian poets had twisted the pliant elegy resulted in certain words or types of words, such as the Russian equivalents of fol amour or langoureux et rêvant, being coupled again and again, and this later lyricists could not shake off for a whole century. In an especially obsessive arrangement, peculiar to the iambic of 4 to 6 feet, a long, wriggly adjective would occupy the first 4 or 5 syllables of the last 3 feet of the line. A good tetrametric example would be Terpi bezchilenie muki, endure incalculable torments. The young Russian poet was liable to slide with fatal ease into this alluring abyss of syllables, for the illustration of which I have chosen bezchilenie only because it translates well. The real favorites were such typical elegiac components as zadumchivye, pensive, utrachenye, lost, Muchitelnya, anguished, and so forth, all accented on the second syllable. Despite its great length, a word of that kind had but a single accent of its own, and consequently the penultimate metrical stress of the line encountered a normally unstressed syllable, ni in the Russian example, la in the English one. This produced a pleasant scud, which, however, was much too familiar an effect to redeem banality of meaning. An innocent beginner, I fell into all the traps laid by the singing epithet. Not that I did not struggle. In fact, I was working at my elegy very hard, taking endless trouble over every line, choosing and rejecting, rolling the words on my tongue with the glazed-eye solemnity of a tea-taster. And still it would come, that atrocious betrayal. The frame impelled the picture. The husk shaped the pulp. The hackneyed order of words, short verb or pronoun, long adjective, short noun, engendered the hackneyed disorder of thought, and some such line as poeta goresnye griozi, translatable and accented as the poet's melancholy daydreams, led fatally to a rhyming line ending in rosy, roses, or beriozi, birches, or grozy, thunderstorms, so that certain emotions were connected with certain surroundings not by a free act of one's will, but by the faded ribbon of tradition. Nonetheless, the nearer my poem got to its completion, the more certain I became that whatever I saw before me would be seen by others. As I focused my eyes upon a kidney-shaped flowerbed, and noted one pink petal lying on the loam and a small ant investigating its decayed edge, or considered the tanned midriff of a birch trunk where some hoodlum had stripped it of its papery pepper-and-salt bark, I really believed that all this would be perceived by the reader through the magic veil of my words such as Utorachenye Rosi or Zadumchivoy Beryosi. It did not occur to me, then, that far from being a veil, those poor words were so opaque that in fact they formed a wall in which all one could distinguish were the well-worn bits of the major and minor poets I imitated. Years later, in the squalid suburb of a foreign town, I remember seeing a paling, the boards of which had been brought from some other place where they had been used, apparently, as the enclosure of an itinerant circus. Animals had been painted on it by a versatile barker. But whoever had removed the boards, and then knocked them together again, must have been blind or insane, for now the fence showed only disjointed parts of animals, some of them, moreover, upside down. A tawny haunch, a zebra's head, the leg of an elephant. 4. On the physical plane, my intense labors were marked by a number of dim actions or postures, such as walking, sitting, lying. Each of these broke again into fragments of no spatial importance. At the walking stage, for instance, I might be wandering one moment in the depths of the park, and the next pacing the rooms of the house. Or to take the sitting stage, I would suddenly become aware that a plate of something I could not even remember having sampled was being removed, and that my mother, her left cheek twitching as it did whenever she worried, was narrowly observing from her place at the top of the long table my moodiness and lack of appetite. I would lift my head to explain, but the table had gone, and I was sitting alone on a roadside stump, the stick of my butterfly net in metronomic motion, drawing arc after arc on the brownish sand. Earthen rainbows, with variations in depth of stroke, rendering the different colors. When I was irrevocably committed to finish my poem or die, there came the most trance-like state of all. With hardly a twinge of surprise, I found myself, of all places, on a leathern couch in the cold, musty, little-used room that had been my grandfather's study. On that couch I lay prone in a kind of reptilian freeze, one arm dangling, so that my knuckles loosely touched the floral figures of the carpet. When next I came out of that trance, the greenish flora was still there, my arm was still dangling, but now I was prostrate on the edge of a rickety wharf, and the water lilies I touched were real, and the undulating, plump shadows of alder foliage on the water, apotheosized inkblots, oversized amoebas, were rhythmically palpitating, extending and drawing in dark pseudopods which, when contracted, would break at their rounded margins into elusive and fluid macules, and these would come together again to reshape the groping terminals. I relapsed into my private mist, and when I emerged again, the support of my extended body had become a low bench in the park, and the live shadows among which my hand dipped now moved on the ground among violet tints instead of aqueous black and green. So little did ordinary measures of existence mean in that state that I would not have been surprised to come out of its tunnel right into the park of Versailles, or the Tiergarten, or Sequoia National Forest. And inversely, when the old trance occurs nowadays, I am quite prepared to find myself, when I awaken from it, high up in a certain tree, above the dappled bench of my boyhood, my belly pressed against a thick, comfortable branch, and one arm hanging down among the leaves upon which the shadows of other leaves move. Various sounds reached me in my various situations. It might be the dinner gong, or something less usual, such as the foul music of a barrel organ. Somewhere near the stables the old tramp would grind, and on the strength of more direct impressions imbibed in earlier years, I would see him mentally from my perch. Painted on the front of his instrument were Balkan peasants of sorts, dancing among palmoid willows. Every now and then he shifted the crank from one hand to the other. I saw the jersey and skirt of his little bald female monkey, her collar, the raw sore on her back, the chain, which she kept plucking at every time the man pulled it, hurting her badly, and the several servants standing around, gaping, grinning, simple folks, terribly tickled by a monkey's antics. Only the other day, near the place where I am recording these matters, I came across a farmer and his son, the kind of keen, healthy kid you see in breakfast food ads, who were similarly diverted by the sight of a young cat torturing a baby chipmunk, letting him run a few inches and then pouncing upon him again. Most of his tail was gone, the stump was bleeding. As he could not escape by running, the game little fellow tried one last measure. He stopped and lay down on his side in order to merge with a bit of light and shade on the ground, but the too violent heaving of his flank gave him away. The family phonograph, which the advent of the evening set in action, was another musical machine I could hear through my verse. On the veranda where our relatives and friends assembled, it emitted from its brass mouthpiece the so-called Tsiganskie romanzi, beloved of my generation. These were more or less anonymous imitations of gypsy songs, or imitations of such imitations. What constituted their gypsiness was a deep, monotonous moan, broken by a kind of hiccup, the audible cracking of a lovesick heart. At their best, they were responsible for the raucous note vibrating here and there in the works of true poets. I am thinking especially of Alexander Bloch. At their worst, they could be likened to the apache stuff composed by mild men of letters and delivered by thick-set ladies in Parisian nightclubs. Their natural environment was characterized by nightingales in tears, lilacs in bloom, and the alleys of whispering trees that graced the parks of the landed gentry. Those nightingales trilled, and in a pine grove the setting sun banded the trunks at different levels with fiery red. A tambourine, still throbbing, seemed to lie on the darkening moss. For a spell, the last notes of the husky contralto pursued me through the dusk. When silence returned, my first poem was ready. 5. It was indeed a miserable concoction, containing many borrowings besides its pseudo-Pushkinian modulations. An echo of Tyutchev's thunder and a refracted sunbeam from Fet were alone excusable. For the rest, I vaguely remember the mention of memory's sting, Vospominania Jalo, which I had really visualized as the ovipositor of an ichneumon fly straddling a cabbage caterpillar, but had not dared say so, and something about the old-world charm of a distant barrel organ. Worst of all were the shameful gleanings from Aputin's and Grand Duke Constantine's lyrics of the Tsigansky type. They used to be persistently pressed upon me by a youngish and rather attractive aunt, who could also spout Louis Bouilliet's famous piece, A Une Femme, in which a metaphorical violin bow is incongruously used to play on a metaphorical guitar, and lots of stuff by Ella Wheeler Wilcox, a tremendous hit with the Empress and her ladies-in-waiting. It seems hardly worthwhile to add that, as themes go, my elegy dealt with the loss of a beloved mistress, Delia, Tamara, or Lenore, whom I had never lost, never loved, never met, but was all set to meet, love, lose. In my foolish innocence, I believed that what I had written was a beautiful and wonderful thing. As I carried it homeward, still unwritten, but so complete that even its punctuation marks were impressed on my brain like a pillow crease on a sleeper's flesh, I did not doubt that my mother would greet my achievement with glad tears of pride. The possibility of her being much too engrossed that particular night in other events to listen to verse did not enter my mind at all. Never in my life had I craved more for her praise. Never had I been more vulnerable. My nerves were on edge because of the darkness of the earth, which I had not noticed muffling itself up, and the nakedness of the firmament, the disrobing of which I had not noticed either. Overhead, between the formless trees bordering my dissolving path, the night sky was pale with stars. In those years, that marvelous mess of constellations, nebulae, interstellar gaps, and all the rest of the awesome show provoked in me an indescribable sense of nausea, of utter panic, as if I were hanging from Earth upside down on the brink of infinite space, with terrestrial gravity still holding me by the heels, but about to release me any moment. Except for two corner windows in the upper story, my mother's sitting room, the house was already dark. The night watchman let me in, and slowly, carefully, so as not to disturb the arrangement of words in my aching head, I mounted the stairs. My mother reclined on the sofa with a St. Petersburg Wretch in her hands and an unopened London Times in her lap. A white telephone gleamed on the glass-topped table near her. Late as it was, she still kept expecting my father to call from St. Petersburg, where he was being detained by the tension of approaching war. An armchair stood by the sofa, but I always avoided it because of its golden satin, the mere sight of which caused a lanciniate shiver to branch from my spine like nocturnal lightning. With a little cough, I sat down on a footstool and started my recitation. While thus engaged, I kept staring at the farther wall, upon which I see so clearly in retrospect some small daguerreotypes and silhouettes in oval frames, a Somov aquarelle, young birch trees, the half of a rainbow, everything very melting and moist, a splendid Versailles autumn by Alexandre Benois, and a crayon drawing my mother's mother had made in her girlhood, that park pavilion again with its pretty windows partly screened by linked branches. The Somov and the Benois are now in some Soviet museum, but that pavilion will never be nationalized. As my memory hesitated for a moment on the threshold of the last stanza, where so many opening words had been tried that the finally selected one was now somewhat camouflaged by an array of false entrances, I heard my mother sniff. Presently I finished reciting and looked up at her. She was smiling ecstatically through the tears that streamed down her face. "How wonderful, how beautiful," she said, and with the tenderness in her smile still growing, she passed me a hand mirror so that I might see the smear of blood on my cheekbone where at some indeterminable time I had crushed a gorged mosquito by the unconscious act of propping my cheek on my fist. But I saw more than that. Looking into my own eyes, I had the shocking sensation of finding the mere dregs of my usual self, odds and ends of an evaporated identity, which it took my reason quite an effort to gather again in the glass. Chapter 12 1 When I first met Tamara, to give her a name concolorous with her real one, she was 15, and I was a year older. The place was the rugged but comely country, black fir, white birch, peat bogs, hayfields, and barrens, just south of St. Petersburg. A distant war was dragging on. 2 years later, that trite deus ex machina, the Russian Revolution, came, causing my removal from the unforgettable scenery. In fact, already then, in July 1915, dim omens and backstage rumblings, the hot breath of fabulous upheavals were affecting the so-called symbolist school of Russian poetry, especially the verse of Alexander Blok. During the beginning of that summer and all through the previous one, Tamara's name had kept cropping up, with the feigned naivete so typical of fate when meaning business, here and there on our estate, entry forbidden, and on my uncle's land, entry strictly forbidden, on the opposite bank of the Oradesh. I would find it written with a stick on the reddish sand of a park avenue, or penciled on a whitewashed wicket, or freshly carved, but not completed, in the wood of some ancient bench, as if Mother Nature were giving me mysterious advance notices of Tamara's existence. That hushed July afternoon, when I discovered her standing quite still, only her eyes were moving, in a birch grove, she seemed to have been spontaneously generated there among those watchful trees with the silent completeness of a mythological manifestation. She slapped dead the horsefly that she had been waiting for to light and proceeded to catch up with two other, less pretty girls who were calling to her. Presently, from a vantage point above the river, I saw them walking over the bridge, clicking along on brisk high heels, all three with their hands tucked into the pockets of their navy blue jackets, and because of the flies, every now and then tossing their beribboned and beflowered heads. Very soon I traced Tamara to the modest dachka summer cottage that her family rented in the village. I would ride my horse or my bicycle in the vicinity, and with a sudden sensation of a dazzling explosion, after which my heart would take quite a time to get back from where it had landed, I used to come across Tamara at this or that bland bend of the road. Mother Nature eliminated first one of her girl companions, then the other, but not until August, August 9, 1915, to be Petrarchically exact, at 4:30 of that season's fairest afternoon in the rainbow-windowed pavilion, that I had noticed my trespasser enter. Not until then did I muster sufficient courage to speak to her. Seen through the carefully wiped lenses of time, the beauty of her face is as near and glowing as ever. She was short and a trifle on the plump side, but very graceful, with her slim ankles and supple waist. A drop of Tatar or Circassian blood might have accounted for the slight slant of her merry dark eye and the duskiness of her blooming cheek. A light down, akin to that found on fruit of the almond group, lined her profile with a fine rim of radiance. She accused her rich brown hair of being unruly and oppressive, and threatened to have it bobbed, and did have it bobbed a year later, but I always recall it as it looked first, fiercely braided into a thick plait that was looped up at the back of her head, and tied there with a big bow of black silk. Her lovely neck was always bare, even in winter in St. Petersburg, for she had managed to obtain permission to eschew the stifling collar of a Russian schoolgirl's uniform. Whenever she made a funny remark or produced a jingle from her vast store of minor poetry, she had a most winning way of dilating her nostrils with a little snort of amusement. Still, I was never quite sure when she was serious and when she was not. The rippling of her ready laughter, her rapid speech, the roll of her very uvular R, the tender, moist gleam on her lower eyelid. Indeed, all her features were ecstatically fascinating to me, but somehow or other, instead of divulging her person, they tended to form a brilliant veil in which I got entangled every time I tried to learn more about her. When I used to tell her we would marry in the last days of 1917, as soon as I had finished school, she would quietly call me a fool. I visualized her home, but vaguely. Her mother's first name and patronymic, which were all I knew of the woman, had merchant class or clerical connotations. Her father, who I gathered took hardly any interest in his family, was the steward of a large estate somewhere in the south. Autumn came early that year. Layers of fallen leaves piled up ankle-deep by the end of August. Velvet-black Camberwell beauties with creamy borders sailed through the glades. The tutor to whose erratic care my brother and I were entrusted that season used to hide in the bushes in order to spy upon Tamara and me with the aid of an old telescope he had found in the attic. But in his turn, one day, the peeper was observed by my uncle's purple-nosed old gardener, Apostolsky, incidentally a great tumbler of weeding girls, who very kindly reported it to my mother. She could not tolerate snooping. And besides, though I never spoke to her about Tamara, she knew all she cared to know of my romance from my poems, which I recited to her in a spirit of praiseworthy objectivity, and which she lovingly copied out in a special album. My father was away with his regiment. He did feel it his duty, after acquainting himself with the stuff, to ask me some rather awkward questions when he returned from the front a month later. But my mother's purity of heart had carried her, and was to carry her, over worse difficulties. She contented herself with shaking her head dubiously, though not untenderly, and telling the butler to leave every night some fruit for me on the lighted veranda. I took my adorable girl to all those secret spots in the woods where I had daydreamed so ardently of meeting her, of creating her. In one particular pine grove, everything fell into place. I parted the fabric of fancy. I tasted reality. As my uncle was absent that year, we could also stray freely in his huge, dense, two-story old park, with its classical cripples of green-stained stone in the main avenue and labyrinthine paths radiating from a central fountain. We walked swinging hands, country fashion. I picked dahlias for her on the borders along the gravel drive, under the distant, benevolent eye of old Priapostolsky. We felt less safe when I used to see her home or near home, or at least to the village bridge. I remember the coarse graffiti linking our first names in strange diminutives on a certain white gate, and a little apart from that village idiot scrawl, the adage, "Prudence is the friend of passion," in a bristly hand well known to me. Once at sunset, near the Orange and Black River, a young Dutchnik, vacationist with a riding crop in his hand, bowed to her in passing, whereupon she blushed like a girl in a novel, but only said, with a spirited sneer, that he had never ridden a horse in his life.